Good morning, everybody. We're going to go ahead and get started because this is a very important action-packed session, and it's been allotted very little time. So you'll probably lose a little bit of your coffee break, but we need to get started. And as a result, the introductions will be very short. Our first presenter is Mike Casey from Indiana University, where he serves as Director of Technical Operations in the IU Media Preservation and Media Digitization and Preservation Initiative, which he will talk about.
Well done, Mark. Good morning. I want to talk with you about why it is absolutely imperative to begin digitizing audio and video recordings sooner rather than later.
Could you speak a little louder, please?
Yes.
Old fellows have a hard time hearing.
And some of us old fellows have a hard time speaking. I will do my best. In order to talk about the subject, I'm going to tell you first just a little bit of a story. Now, we all know how stories begin, right? And you can help me start the story at the count of three. One, two, three. Once upon a time, there was a king and a queen who ruled the kingdom of Media. Now, Media was a peaceful land. Its subjects, maybe I should call them objects, lived happy analog lives where preservation and access and the means of production all revolved around the physical object. But the king and the queen had heard the winds of change blowing. They had heard rumors of an unspeakable evil at the borderlands of their kingdom. They knew that the old ways could hold fast no longer. Perhaps they had heard and we're familiar, as we are today, with this quote from our own National Recording Preservation Board. We would now amend this. This is a bit old, to say within a generation or less. Or from our international colleagues in YASA, telling us that this combination of degradation and obsolescence may in the end defeat us. And yet we know this from our own National Recording Preservation Plan. So what is the problem? I can sum this up with a set of keywords, which you see up on the screen, which I will try to string together in one very long run-on sentence that goes something like this. That is that we have very large numbers of analog and physical digital objects actively degrading, carried on highly obsolete formats, that many of which carry high research value, for which we have a very short time window to take action. Let's unpack this statement just a little bit. Here are some numbers from IU, Indiana University. There are surely other institutions that have comparable or higher numbers as well, but the basic point, there's a lot of stuff on the IU campus. And we know that all analog and physical digital objects are actively degrading, some catastrophically, so we need to come to terms with all of the different problems and issues appearing on the screen right now in order to get the best playback from these deteriorating objects on obsolete formats, including that last one that appeared, undiagnosed unplayability. That one's really my favorite. It means you can't play the darn thing and we have no idea why. But we still have to play it. Some images of degradation from the Bloomington campus. Lacquer disc with plasticizer problems. The end game for lacquer discs. We lost the chance to digitize this one at the Archives of Traditional Music. It can no longer be played. Cylinder with efflorescence issues. The results of videotape degradation, and even motion picture film. This is vinegar syndrome. If degradation is one part of the puzzle or the challenge, the other piece that is comparable is clearly obsolescence. This is obsolescence not just to the media formats, but trying to get the playback machines, the spare parts, even the expertise to know how to manipulate a deteriorating carrier on an obsolete machine in an obsolete format. It's getting very scarce. Let's take a look at a few examples. Does anybody rely on Technics SP15 turntables to do your work? Yes, so do we. Trouble if that bearing goes out. Some Sony DAT machines, parts unavailable. Audio alignment tapes, one company. I hear there's somebody younger than the proprietor who's fairly up there in years who's been working, but this is clearly a fragile part of our industry. Last run of playback heads for Studer tape machines. We can still get playback heads in the US from Flux Magnetics, but that's the only company in the world that I know of that's making playback heads. 1-inch video, if you need a Type C head assembly, the most common type in the US, it's gonna cost you. Let's take a look at one format and dive a little bit deeper into it. Quad. This is a standard video format, 2-inch quad tape. It's not niche, nothing special about it. It's the way the video was done for many, many years. People estimate there's less than 200 machines left in the world. Some parts for some machines are no longer available. If you use these machines to digitize on a daily basis, the heads need to be replaced roughly every 3 months. How do you do that? Go to the one company that has one technician that is still doing this work. I think I got the age wrong. I've recently been told that he's actually 75. His company has been appealing for money, not very successfully. They have trouble getting supplies to do their work. Here was the cost in 2009 for a new playback head every 3 months. 2012, the cost jumped up to this. This is only going up. All of these are important. They're part of a longer list that I could give to you, but the basic point is this. Everything is on this slope. Some are further down to the bottom than others. We can now clearly guess that there are no longer enough working playback machines to cover all of the audio and video formats held at institutions around the world. We've been watching in the last couple of years as audio equipment has quadrupled in price on eBay. All of which causes Richard Wright to make this statement about video. Richard's formerly with the BBC and is quite well known in our community. Richard ran some numbers, estimating that 75% of the video held in Europe will be lost in about 10 years. Clifford Lynch, digital preservation pioneer, has this to say about these issues. In the meantime, the borderlands of the kingdom of media, the king and the queen have learned that degradation and obsolescence have joined forces and spawned an evil twin-headed monster called degralescence. They immediately sent to the neighboring kingdom for help. They summoned Prince Kodak. Now, I have to tell you the truth. When degralescence heard this, he just laughed, spat upon the ground, and said, "I eat Kodaks for lunch." Which was true. But Prince Kodak knew that he had on his side the sword of migration, and it was that that he would pin his hopes on. And still the sands of time continue to slip away. How much time do we have? Many of us, myself included, have been saying 15 to 20 years. I've been saying this for about 8 or 9 years now. And now our National Recording Preservation Plan has made the same statement. It's helpful to have this in print, I think. Clearly less for some formats. What we think the end game will be after this time period is that this combination of degradation and obsolescence will just make it impossible or just prohibitively expensive to digitize large holdings. Some vendors and a few institutions like the Library of Congress are stockpiling expertise and equipment to try to push back the boundaries of this time frame. But how much time do we really have? Here's what I think. With a focus on 10, not 15. How long will it take? That's a reasonable question to ask. We ran some numbers at IU, at the Archives of Traditional Music, with one audio engineer doing one recording at a time, one by one by one by one. That's what we came up with. The music library at IU, same situation. We simply do not have this kind of time. So we decided that our efforts needed to be massive, rapid, and yet considered. We don't want to throw away preservation principles. So the battle is on. Degralescence is now attacking the heart of the kingdom of media. Prince Kodak is riding to the rescue, trying to save what he can. We'll see what happens. At IU, we've been taking some steps to try to weather this storm. Now, many of you are familiar with this, the Media Preservation Survey that we published in 2009. The Meeting the Challenge Planning document in 2011. Both of these are available on the web if you're interested. Take us up to our State of the University address by our president last October, in which he announced the creation of the Media Digitization and Preservation Initiative. And even more importantly, he announced funding to digitize all significant audio and video objects and to create a master plan for more than just the time-based media. He also wants to see a master plan for still images and manuscripts. So this is a 5-year plan to digitize all audio and video. It's to be done by the IU Bicentennial in 2020. My take on the 5-year time frame, roughly the same as David Bowie's. Who can name the album that this comes from? Ziggy Stardust, of course. This effort is funded at the highest levels of campus. It's a university-wide initiative, so we need to now come to terms with recordings held on other IU campuses outside of Bloomington. And it does not include film. Film has its own technical issues and challenges, so film will be a separate proposal. And in fact, we have an RFI that we've just issued, be followed by an RFP. So there's more news to come from IU in terms of film. In order to pull this off, we have formed a partnership with a private company, Memnon Archiving Services, home base in Brussels. You can see a view there of one of their parallel transfer facilities. Memnon's the largest digitization player in Europe. They're very experienced. They're at work in other parts of the world as well. So the strategy is for Memnon to digitize most of the recordings using what we call parallel transfer workflows, doing more than one recording at a time. IU will also, and Memnon is currently in the midst of setting up shop on the Bloomington campus in order to do this. IU will also have a small digitization facility in which it will handle the fragile things, the lacquer discs, the wax cylinders, that need to go to a one-to-one workflow and be done one object at a time. Together, we'll digitize more than 350,000 recordings in 5 years, starting very, very soon. In our story, Degrelescence is brought under control, chiefly through the use of the sword of migration. But Degrelescence never completely goes away. Degrelescence is always upon us, but can be diminished. That's the end of the story. The end of the story for you and I, for my institution and your institution, is not yet written.
Thank you, Mike. In the interest of time, to allow Chris enough time to get his presentation, we're going to hold questions until after Chris is done in their joint presentation, and that way you can eat into your own coffee breaks and we won't be forcing it on you. In the meantime, here is Chris Lucinic.
Thanks, Mark. That's a hard story to follow, I think. So I'm Chris Lucinic from AV Preserve, and I'm going to pick up where Mike left off. I think he made a great case for explaining why obsolescence and degradation are a real issue. And I'm gonna start kind of where Mike left off, at the end. The end of what? Well, the end of audiovisual physical media. And this is something most institutions that have audiovisual holdings understand that the end, it's a general notion, but in most cases they think maybe this is somebody for the next person. It's not my problem to worry about. When you put it on a timeline, it gets a little bit more attention. We've seen, you know, articles in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that have started to call some attention to this issue, actually. But still, we see people kind of wax philosophical about the virtues of grooved media over magnetic media, and people put a lot of stock in technological heroism coming in, saving the day at the last minute. It will certainly save us. We can let this go. Certainly some smart person in some smart lab will think of a way to solve this problem at some point. And sometimes we find ourselves at the end, or at least at the risk of the end, with things like, you know, the recent Hurricane Sandy, or maybe a disaster in a facility. And these are really interesting moments, because in these moments people spring into action, right? They'll spare every effort, or they will spare no effort, they'll spare no expense, and the items are recognized as priceless materials, you know, culturally significant. People get very dedicated and passionate in these moments. And there's stories that came out around Hurricane Sandy that were remarkable, you know, these volunteer efforts to save audiovisual materials and all kinds of other materials that were in archives that were flooded and damaged. And it's really amazing. But it's interesting to look at that in response and in contrast to how organizations, how we as a community are acting in response to this longer-term disaster, which, for the purpose of today, to be generous, we'll call 14 years. But as Mike said, 14 years isn't good, because in 5 years we'll still be calling it 14 years. So let's call it 2028. And in fact, that slide used to say 15 years when I started talking about this last year, and so I kept it still at 2028. But it's imperative that we take the perspective and effort found at this moment and we apply it to this timeline. Because there's many organizations that would spring into action and act just like we talked about in a sudden disaster, but currently are standing by while this plays out in front of us without acting in any way or in ways that in which this issue deserves. So I'd like to think about, you know, stakeholders and caretakers in collections to really think about some questions. If their materials were put at risk today under certain disaster, you know, would they do everything? Would I do everything to save my collection? What is that? What is everything? What resources could I garner? What effort would I go to? What are the things that I would do? What are the resources that I would bring to bear to respond? How much would I do and spend before I thought it was too much? And this is not me standing high and mighty here. I think these are actually very real questions that we need to come to terms with, because I don't think the answer is there is no end of expense or effort. I think that there's a real answer to this question, but until we put it on the table, we can't have a real conversation about how we prioritize, how we act. And so, and would I be inspired or shamed by the passion of others to save my collection? So we saw this in Hurricane Sandy. We worked with this amazing organization, iBeam Arts. We, as a volunteer effort, we led to save their collection of audiovisual materials that were flooded there on the west side in Manhattan. And this happened. I mean, they had this amazing collection, and when this happened, a community came together that really put a lot of value in their collection, and they sprung into action, there was a lot of effort, a lot of passion. It was really a really moving gesture, and it did cause iBeam to refocus. They took a step back and they said, "Wow, we now realize like we haven't put the value, we hadn't even thought of what we had amassed over the years, but because others have kind of, you know, through the eyes of others, we've been able to recognize the value of what we have, and it's caused them to refocus on their archive, and they've gone after funding, and they're doing all kinds of great things now to really make sure that those things are preserved and accessible." But, you know, these questions are as relevant to this longer timeline as they are to a sudden disaster. And it's important that we start to act now, because this is no longer a marathon. This is, for most organizations, a sprint to get there. But it's also true that this is a totally overwhelming task for many organizations, right? And this report, which was published back in 2010, Sustainable Economics for a Digital Planet, from the Blue Ribbon Task Force, is a great resource for helping to think how to navigate these realities. And there's some really important concepts. One is they talk about the common misperception that it's everything or nothing, forever or never. We often get trapped in the paralysis of these types of black and white thoughts, or pressing the point that the thing that we need to focus on is what do we need to do to maintain the option to make a decision, right? If we do nothing, if we do not digitize, we lose the option after things are lost to make any decision about whether we want to do a little to preserve things, do a lot to make them very accessible. The option's taken off the table. So we can think about what is the minimum amount we can do to just preserve the option to have a decision, not 100 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now. But the most important thing is that we need to do something. Immediacy is a really key element. We need to take action in some way, some shape. We need to start getting momentum and having progress. We can't just be paralyzed by kind of black and white, you know, the massiveness of it and the kind of thinking about having to do everything. We need to prioritize. And actually, I think that's a great thing out of the IU reports that Mike mentioned. I mean, there's a lot of discussion in there about prioritization and how they've tackled prioritization. And I think those are really great models to follow and ways to think about it. But regardless of the approach and perspective, the reality of the situation is it takes resources, right? This is, under any circumstances, takes significant resources to tackle. And the place where efforts within organizations often start to fall short is when you build momentum and you go into a meeting with the executives or higher level administration within an organization. And there's a certain conversation that always starts to creep in, and that is, if we digitize these things, how will we recoup our costs or even make money through monetization, right? And I would argue that this is an inaccurate, anemic, you know, it's a data point, but it's not representative often of the actual value that's derived for an organization by responding to these issues. But the other thing from a financial perspective is that this is not actually what the expense curve looks like, right? It doesn't start at zero this year. The reality is that organizations have been spending money for many years on their collections. They have been doing things like staffing them, temperature and humidity control, rehousing projects, consultants. There's been migration efforts. There's been lots and lots of expenses in most cases put into managing these collections to get them to today. So it's important that we recognize that expense, that we put that on the table as a part of the conversation, and that we actually run some calculations around that. So what we've done at AV Preserve is to build a tool to help organizations do this. It's called COI as opposed to ROI, which if you're in the insurance industry, that means certificate of insurance, but hopefully nobody's confused here. But it is the cost of inaction, and it helps people get their head around both the financial implications, but also the intellectual implications. But this is important because I think as a community, we've struggled for many years to really figure out how do we make an argument. Because we get into these environments, we go to conferences, we talk with like-minded people, and we share a lot of the same sentiment and spirit about the richness and the importance and the significance of the materials that we are familiar with and that we know and we love and we see the significance of. But that doesn't translate when you start talking to administrators and executives and decision makers and budget holders in the same way as it does in this room. And so we've often fallen short in our argument, what we want to do is add another point to that conversation, which is around finances. So this is within COI, which I'll show you in a second. You're able to do things like build scenarios. So this shows us, for instance, you know, for a given digitization budget, if we start in 2020 instead of in 2014, we're likely to lose over 20,000 more items in a 50,000 item collection and lose over $3 million of investment, right? So that kind of says, what if we can start to answer questions about what if we move the timeline? What if we don't start today, but we start in 2020 instead? Or answer the question, you know, what if we spend a third of the money, but we start today? What are the implications to this? And we see a similar outcome. And the argument here is not to do everything. As I said before, this is not an impassioned argument to do everything. It's to do something and to make an informed decision. It's to have the information. It's right. In most organizations, you walk into, you talk with the people that work with collections. I haven't found anybody that's not willing to be reasonable and say, you know what, everything we have is not worth preserving. And you can find several stakeholders within an organization that will agree with that statement. So this is about, look, we're up against a wall. We have a lot of work to do. We have to prioritize. Let's make some informed decisions. So this is the Cost of Inaction Calculator website. You can find it at coi.avpreserve.com. And I'll walk you through a little bit of what it does, and maybe we'll chance the internet and see if we can get it to work a little bit after I show you these screen grabs. So this is the main analysis page, and up at the top there are several parameters that you would punch in, and these are things like last year for magnetic media. So there are certain things that we make default settings or assumptions, but we allow users to change this. If you disagree, the default is 2028. If you want to see what if the real end of magnetic media is 2050 or 2020, you can change that and see the implications. One important thing is this is not an expiration date, right? We don't have 100% of our things and then on the kill date lose it all. This is what we know is a logarithmic curve where we will lose things each and every month, each and every year between now and this date. And that actually is this red curve here that we see. So this curve, this is physical media. And no matter what we do, that's going to happen. The timeline we could argue about, but that will happen. So the other parameters are what is the size of your collection, the size of audio versus video, what is the investment to date for media for this collection? And this is going to be different for different types of organizations. So for archives, they have a different set of expenses and investments than, say, a production company that's gone through things. Some organizations acquire collections. They pay for collections, and others do not. So there's different things that feed into this, but to come to some understanding of this, we need to know, what is the investment we've spent so far? How much will we spend per item moving forward per year? And of course, to get to a precise number we know is difficult, but I will point out that in many other fields and industries, these numbers, you know, I've entered into some conversations and people act as if these are ridiculous questions. It's actually very common these are like key metrics that we should, as a community, as a field, as a professional field, these are things we should be able to answer actually pretty well. These are things that we should be able to speak to. And in fact, we've worked with lots of organizations on using this, and people, once you sit down and you have a conversation, it's actually pretty easy to get to some numbers that people can agree to as reasonable projections. We have a digitization cost per item. So if we were to go about digitization, and these are averaged out, and you can change this, and it's different from institution to institution. Some have internal costs. So they say, we have an internal lab, and we realize it costs us this much to do this, or we outsource over the past X number of years, and this has been our average. Related to that, we have an assumption built in annual increase in cost of digitization. So I don't think there's a lot of controversy in saying that we are at historic low prices for digitization right now. And that's not gonna last, right? There's lots of reasons that Mike just pointed out, that just from a you know, pure economics, there's gonna be a lot of it's gonna only get harder, expertise becomes more rare, parts become more rare, it's gonna become more expensive to do this work over time. And so we wanna project that in, and that plays into, you know, how soon we act, what the implications are. Annual digitization budget. We factor in storage as well. So here we use Amazon as a common reference because it's accessible. It's not necessarily what we're promoting, although we're not against it either. But it is it's a transparent reference point for cost of storage. And our assumptions are around using standard preservation, master, uncompressed, a mezzanine of 44/116 and a low resolution of MP3 320 kilobits or something like that. So there's assumptions built in around what the destination formats are, and then how much it's gonna cost to store those things. But if you have an internal storage cost, you can add your own cost to start to project these things. So by entering in these parameters, we're able to actually run some analyses, both financial and say, here's the investment we've made. This black line here is investment made, and the blue line here is investment saved, right? And it's saved because through digitization, we save the content, and therefore we save our investment in it. In this scenario, we catch up in time, so there's actually no loss. This green line is a separate, sorry, my cursor has escaped me. Well, the green line on the left part is that's by itself is the cost for digitization and storage. There's another analysis that looks at the implications of when we start. So these sound somewhat similar, but this says, if we start on a given year, and when we start, we do everything we can to not lose any more, right? So let's say we start in 2015, and we say, we know we're gonna lose some stuff between now and 2015, but at the point we start digitizing things, we will not lose any more. What's the amount of money we would have to invest to save everything at that point? And how many things would we lose? So we can look at this and say that, you know, if you start in 2017, you will spend/lose $1.7 million more in this scenario than if you started in 2014. So you can start to do some really important, you know, cost-benefit analyses and look at, like, what is an optimal time to start? When does it make sense? And you can do all kinds of things here as far as we want people to use this for presentations. We imagine that people will run various scenarios, what-if scenarios. What if we start here versus here? What if we spend this versus this? What if the cost of digitization is this instead of this? And so what we've done is all of this data, everything on this page is exportable as a JPEG or PNG or whatever to import to be able to put into presentations and things and be able to present on this. And not only is it these charts, but there's also tables as well, which you can, that actually gives you all of the data that's that those charts are representing, so you can take the information and use it. You can export it either as an image or as a CSV, so you can bring it into a spreadsheet application and work with it there if you like. And we also have some key findings. We've inserted the concept of return, but it's based on money saved, not on not return on investment of new expenses, but return on past investments, if you will. And if you log in and sign up, you can save various scenarios, so you can come back and revisit them later. You can also share a link with colleagues for people who don't have to be logged in to share, you know, send a link to somebody and say, hey, here's the scenarios we're looking at. So you can share it as well. And so I would encourage you to go and check this out. I know it's a lot of it's a dry topic to talk about in the context of a presentation, but I think that what you will find is that there's a lot of good information that's useful to help run some analyses to start to be able to take something other than an argument, you know, an impassioned argument about the intellectual loss and cultural significance that we stand to lose by not acting, and actually take, you know, along with that argument some financial information and some metrics around actually the number of objects and things like this that we lose. I think it you know, our hope here today is that we bolster the argument to take action in some way, in some shape, in some form, and get progress going. So what time, how are we doing on time?
10:45.
Yeah, okay. So if we could just quickly, I would like to, because we don't want to leave you with no hope, we've just laid a heavy cloud of we want to point to a few organizations that are doing things that I think, again, like these are great things both that are inspiring, but also that you can take to, you know, administrators and say, hey, these organizations are doing things out in the field, and we should be speaking with them. We should be finding out what they're doing, why they're doing the things that they're doing. So I just wanted to run through a couple. So the American Archive is one great example. This is an effort in which they've inventoried over 2.5 million items across public radio and television stations, and are digitizing 40,000 hours in the past. Well, they're halfway there, as we see here on the dashboard, and getting much closer. They're within the year, I think they'll be through 40,000 hours. And I want to point out another thing is it's easy to look at this, and it's easy to hear Mike and say, yeah, well, Indiana University, the American Archive, they got money, of course they're going to do this stuff. But the answer is no. And even in corporations, we find that the archive is the ghetto of the organization. They're underfunded. In each of these cases, including Mike's, what you have is a champion or a group of champions that work, advocate, raise awareness, and build one block at a time. And so I think, you know, when we look at it as the whole, it becomes very overwhelming. But this, the American Archive, took people within, it was born out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, ended up now with the Library of Congress and WGBH. But this was the result of many years of people within the Corporation for Public Broadcasting really advocating for this project and fighting hard and turning in proposal after proposal. So I just don't want, you know, this is not a bunch of people that were handed kind of, you know, silver spoons. These are all people who have really fought. New Jersey Network was defunded, totally taken off the table, no funding. The government of New Jersey basically shut down New Jersey Network within 2 days. They were defunded. WNET and the group that was left in place for New Jersey Network, which is a group of about 4 people, put together a board, started advocating, raising funding, and got it together to do an inventory of their collection, which they had not had. They then used that inventory to actually get into the American Archive Project, which they had originally been left out of because there was no one there to do anything, to get thousands of hours digitized. They've since used that inventory to raise more money. Not only that, but they're providing access. They've actually used this. They have several other organizations that are interested in their collections, and they're making it available to universities. this inventory, who are then coming back and asking for, you know, particular pieces of content to use as parts of curriculum or to use for documentaries. So they're really, I mean, it's really a success story. It's a difficult and challenging one, but they've really done an amazing job. NEDCC, a couple of folks are here from there, are doing some really interesting things. One is the Irene, the machine that does scanning of cylinders and disks that comes from Carl Haber and was used, is also used at the Library of Congress. NEDCC is bringing this to market as an actual service, so where they'll be offering this as a service. You know, I think that it's really innovative. It allows us to do some things that we couldn't do before. But also they're embarking upon a sound preservation study to explore bringing a nonprofit service, a digitization service for audio to the market as well. And as part of that, they're doing, you know, done a really comprehensive survey of holdings and has turned up, I think, some of the best, most comprehensive data to date on this. And this will be, a lot of this will be published as part of the work that they're doing. But I think it gives us some really good information to work with as a community. How many things do we have? What percentage of things have been digitized that are out there in collections? What is the breakdown and allocation of different types of formats and media types? That, of course, this information goes into advocacy and funding as well, right? Because this is resources are a bottom line that we all have to deal with. And so I think NEDCC is doing great stuff by bringing some alternatives to the marketplace and providing, doing a lot of really thorough research on what the need is. University of Maryland, Robin Pike is here, I believe. Again, this story, you know, University of Maryland has very large collections. You have the story of, you know, a small group that recognizes the value that builds and builds and builds over time. You know, Robin has done a lot of work to advocate. She's reaching out to various departments, has established a cross-departmental working group. She's working to be a line item in the budget, right? And you hear her talk about this, and she says, well, I didn't get the two positions that I applied for this year, but I'm going to rework those. I'm going to get them next year, and I'm going to start to get more budgets. She's going out, she's getting budget money from other departments to do digitization at a much larger scale than it's been done, both by building internal capabilities to do it and coming up with hybrid models for outsourcing. But so just lots of advocacy, interesting and innovative ways of getting funds together and working hard there. I don't want to spend too much time. NYPL has just done a great survey of their holdings and is doing a lot of really interesting preservation planning work there on how to approach preservation and access within the New York Public Library. Cornell University just garnered support to do a campus-wide survey of their holdings. And over the past few years have done some great work around building internal capabilities for digitization and preservation. You know, Berea College in Kentucky, a very small college doing amazing things. I mean, it's really just phenomenal in both the work that they've done internally, the standards they're using, the comprehensiveness in which they're tackling the problem. And this is a great example of, you know, this is it's a very small organization with an amazing collection that has been really good about, at the end of the day, it's about advocacy, fundraising, making sure that they're doing what they need to do to make these collections accessible. Indiana University, of course. Stanford, another leader in this, has been, you know, one of the early ones to start doing internal capability development, standards development for doing in-house digitization and preservation. Hannah Frost is just an amazing advocate. They've done some great work, the AV Artifact Atlas, things that are just really, you know, fantastic resources. And this is the last one, just University of Ghana, another of this story where, you know, an organization that had collections of open reel tapes and discs and films literally sitting out on screen porches, you know, the first time that we went to visit them. And just through really a lot of persistence have really engaged in the process of making sure that they have funding. And not only funding for things like digitization, like they're putting a lab together, but they've been really good about, they've gone and done some great collaboration with the IT folks within the University of Ghana to make sure that they're able to procure storage for a preservation, a basic preservation environment post-digitization, and that's through collaborations with Google and various people that they that they're able to kind of get the storage side of things. But you know, so I think that there's lots of reason to be hopeful despite all of the depressing things that Mike and I told you about today. I think so. We hope that you will take these things and use them and to your advantage and to the advantage of all of us, for that matter, in preserving and making collections accessible. Thanks a lot for your time and attention today.
We've gone past our allotted time, so I think we should not do a formal question and answer session so that people feel free to get their little bit of coffee if they need it. But if Mike and Chris agree to stay and answer questions, if they don't need coffee too badly, perhaps you could come forward and have a smaller discussion up here with questions.